Blog Talk Radio.
On the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you'll find us online at speculist.com. That's speculist.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we explore a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities which lie at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
Doing great. Doing really good. Sorry to the guys in the chat room. Just launched the chat room kind of late, and I see people filtering in now.
They're filing in. Dutifully, you know, it's nice to see you all showing up. We'll try to be more prompt in the future, but I think if we have the chat running when the show starts, that is the that is the minimum level of acceptable performance, right? As long as we get that going.
Right. What I should do is what I've been trying to do is have the chat launched about 10 minutes before the show starts, and you know you have the people that show up early, and they get to talking about show topics and stuff before the show actually starts. So that's kind of cool. Every now and then we can get
to pay attention to anything we say, basically.
That's right. Yeah. We have a knowledgeable audience. They know as much about this stuff sometimes as we do. So it's that's pretty awesome.
Cool stuff. Well, 2 weeks from tonight is Halloween, and we were just saying before the show started that 3 weeks from tonight, I guess that would make it, November 7th, the day after the presidential election, very auspicious,
right.
That will be our 250th Fast Forward Radio on Blog Talk Radio. So that's going to be a real special show, and all we'll say for now is that plans are being made. I think that's all we can really reveal at this point. Do you think that's fair?
Yeah, that's fair. And my thought is that we get the loser of the presidential election on the show. I mean, they don't have a lot to do on the day after the election.
They're usually going on vacation right after, you know, usually fishing or something like that.
Yeah,
they can call in. We'll give them the number. Yeah, I think that's an excellent idea. And we can tell them where they went wrong.
You know, if you'd have talked more about these topics, you know, it would have been interesting. You might have still lost, but it would have been more interesting.
It would have been way more entertaining for us. I can tell you that much.
And that's what's important.
Talked about those things. Yeah, well, since you're going to lose anyway, you might as, you know. Just saying. So, what's new in your world? Anything interesting going on?
Well, this weekend we had a great time. Our family we went and to a wedding in the Dallas area, and it was my brother-in-law Mark who got married to a very nice girl, and just had a great time with the entire family. The reception was fun. Got to see my kids dance on the dance floor, and that was
that was a
hoot. All four of my sons and. Particularly with my older one, I was wondering, you know, exactly where do you get that skill, man?
I don't hesitate to get out there.
Yeah, exactly. It's obviously her influence. I don't hesitate to get out there and move around, but I do not imagine that I can actually do it well. You know, it's sort of like, what's the movie Hitched where he says, here's your home?
Yeah. You live here. This is where you are.
Yeah,
right?
This is where you need to stay, right here. Well, that's me, and I've come to grips with that. And but anyway, it was fun to watch the kids. We just really had a good time, and it was.
Oh, that sounds great. Well, congratulations to Mark and his new bride. Wonderful stuff.
Yeah.
We've hit kind of a milestone here at our home too. All three now walking. So obviously the 3-year-old's been walking for a while, but now both twins are mobile. And so,
well, you know what this means, don't you, Phil? I mean, it's informally when you just maybe had two walking what you know, it's one for me to watch, one for you to watch, and
right.
the other one's fine because it's just. But now you got a free agent, you know, that's can be moving around outside of your view. So
I'll tell you, we thought that way anyhow. Ever since my oldest daughter moved first overseas, and now she's living in Chicago, and we've always felt like we had one more child than we had adults to cover because we were really spoiled. She was with us originally when the twins first showed up, and there were, you know, we had a perfect ratio of adults to babies in the house. And,
one, yeah.
Yeah, and now we've been outnumbered for some time, and now they're all walking. So, you know, it's cue the ominous horror movie music, right? It's just,
Well, you'd have to get serious about the baby proofing, I guess, at this point. You know,
ever since Sephra started crawling, yeah, we've been because they as you know, get into everything in the house.
Oh, that's right. What you have to. Well, you know, sofa surfing, that's the point at which they're just kind of sort of toddling from one thing to the next. But it speeds up fast from there. And I guess that's where you're at, huh?
It truly does. Yes. And that's exactly where we are. Well, speaking of things speeding up fast,
yep.
Let's talk about a man who fell to the earth going greater than the speed of sound. Big news story this week, that of one Felix Baumgartner, who took a dive from, I believe it was 28 miles up, 100 and, is that right? 100, no, 128,000 feet. Was that 24 miles up, I think they said?
Yeah, I think it's like 23, 24 miles.
Yeah.
And
I know we're supposed to give all this in metric. I'm sorry, I don't do the metric. I should. But
yeah, the rest of the world does it. That doesn't mean we can. We're handicapped by our U.S. Education.
Well, and like, you know, it would be so hard for me to like do the conversion on one of the 10,000 tools that are readily available to do it. But
hey, this was an assignment for the chat room. Somebody give us in kilometers how high he was. And
yes, we'll, and how fast was he going in KMPH? I know it was about it was over 800 miles per hour. So I can actually do a rough estimate of that, but we'll let someone in the chat room tell us. Anyway, an astounding set of records that Mr. Baumgartner set. It's the highest jump ever. It's the highest altitude ever achieved by a ballooner, by someone in a balloon, and it's the fastest skydive ever achieved. So triple crown there, set three records all at the same time.
He missed a fourth, though. He missed a fourth.
Which is?
Okay. The longest free fall.
There you go. Yeah.
Felix, Joe Kittinger still holds that for the longest free fall. I guess he decided that Joe Kittinger pulled a chute a little later, or for whatever reason, he had a longer free fall than Felix. I heard someone say, well, Felix might have pulled his chute early to preserve one record for his coach and benefactor, Joe Kittinger. I'm not sure, but for whatever reason, he did not break that record.
Well, that is really interesting. That's interesting you bring that up, because obviously Kittinger looms large in our discussion this evening, he being the previous record holder for those three records and still world record holder. That's very interesting for the longest free fall. What's really interesting to me about this is well, there's a number of different tacks we could take in looking at Baumgartner's achievement. I'm in awe of him. I think it takes incredible courage. I think it's a magnificent technical achievement to get a balloon up there and to safely enable someone to pull something like this off. But there are a number of questions that this accomplishment raises, and the one I asked in a post I put up on the Speculus yesterday was, why now? Why is this happening now? Because you mentioned Joe Kittinger, who set those previous records. Do you know when he set them?
1960.
Yeah, 52 years ago these earlier records were set. So one of my takeaways from this, okay, is that there really is hope that we'll get back to the moon. Okay, because it's really interesting that there would be all this interest in aeronautics and seeing how high you can get a balloon to go, seeing how high you can get a skydive accomplishment to occur, you know, like 52 years ago, and then zero interest in it for decades and decades, and then suddenly the whole idea reemerges, and we start making major accomplishments in it again. I think that's kind of cool.
Did the thought cross your mind as it did me that I watched the whole thing. You know, mm-hmm. I watched the ascent and him jumping and the whole deal. But while I was watching that, I was thinking, you know, while he's doing this, you know, and this is not a government project. This is private. You know, we have SpaceX, you know, up at the International Space Station right now. You know, having delivered, a bunch of cargo to the space station, and that's cool. You know, that's a private venture as well, public private, I guess.
Yep.
And I just find that very cool that what we had before in the 60s was our government in a race, obviously, with another government, the Soviet Union, and it took big, huge government efforts to do what was done back then. Now it seems like we're traveling some of the same ground, but this time it's private, and to me, I find that very, very exciting. I mean, that, you know, to me, space gets real when it's just people there for a reason of making money. You know, it's a new space age, perhaps the real space age.
I agree. Interesting comment from Jab in the chat room. This is not space. This is an argument that I haven't seen promulgated too much, and that's one of those great late night barroom kind of debates that you can have. You know, when does it become space? Okay. Sally points out that you can see the curvature of the Earth at that elevation, so I think that's
there is a point at which they say, okay, this is the line, everything above this is space. Jab, what is that altitude? And Jab's saying it's 400,000 feet further. Well, it's just a little bit further than four times as high as it really was.
Four times as high up.
This particular altitude, though, I think we need to get comfortable operating in that altitude for a lot of reasons, Phil. This is the altitude up in the upper in the stratosphere. Like this is where we would put a dark sky station if we wanted to, and there would be a lot of reasons for having such a station like that, and that's been proposed. You could it could be like a telecommunications satellite that you could service on a regular basis, without having to have a space, spacewalk or something.
Right, right.
You know, a weather station. It could be a place that you could launch an orbital flight with one less stage, a stage from there to from the ground to the dark sky station could save significant fuel, I would imagine. So, I don't know. I think we should get comfortable at that altitude. There's lots that could be done there.
Yeah, if it's not space, it's pre-space or something. I'm gonna go ahead and call it space. I think if you can't breathe, and you can see the curvature of the Earth,
if you stepped out of that, if he had stepped out of that capsule without that space suit on, and that's what it was a space suit, right? His blood would have boiled. They call that the Armstrong line. When you pass the Armstrong line, your blood boils. I don't know if that was named for Neil or not, but that's what they call it.
That's very interesting. I hadn't heard that before. I know that a lot of the early rocket plane tests that led to our space program that were occurring concurrently with the Mercury program hit altitudes roughly the same. That, in fact, I'm pretty sure Alan Shepard didn't go too much higher than this in that first flight. So by that definition, even he didn't go into space. Anyway, interesting barroom discussion. We'll leave it for folks.
You say it was space. I'm going to side with Jab and say not quite yet. There's a point that they call space, and that wasn't quite yet.
Saying if it was space, he would have floated away. Now that's not true. That we have to point out. If he was in orbit, he could have floated away, right? But Ken's messing with us, and that's all very well. Okay, so it's funny. We climbed down that interesting rabbit hole discussion of whether it was space, and I forgot where I was going with this discussion of Felix Baumgartner. Oh, now I recall. So the question was, why the big gap in between? Why were there decades and decades when no further such records were set? And I believe there was a comment in the chat room that was because it's meaningless and there's no reason to do this. And I think that that's a good argument. That is probably the argument that the people who were in a position to continue to pursue the records would have exactly given, the U.S. Air Force. They would have said, well, we've established what we need to here, and we've got other projects going on that are more important, things like going to the moon and, you know, fighting the Vietnam War and the Cold War and a lot of other stuff going on. This is not a priority for us. This doesn't get us anything that we need. And I think, Stephen, this was long before there was talk of some of the kinds of practical applications of things at this altitude that are now becoming more and more common to talk about. We're thinking a lot more about lighter-than-air craft being used to do a number of interesting things. So the U.S. government didn't want to do it. They had no reason to do it, and so it didn't happen because this is the kind of project that only the government could do. And that is your parallel right there with SpaceX. There was a time when putting stuff into space was pretty much something that only the government could do. And we've talked about this principle quite a few times on this program over the years. This is something that I've referred to as deindustrialization. I think it needs a bigger name. It needs a broader name. But basically, it's the idea that capabilities that at one time belonged only to the very wealthy, the very powerful, or to governments, right, to the biggest industries, the biggest organizations, or to the largest, most powerful governments on Earth, are filtering their way down into the hands of smaller organizations, smaller enterprises, and in some cases, individuals. And these, both SpaceX and Baumgartner's Jump are interesting examples of that. The kind of program that the Air Force would have once done to send a man up to that height to make sure that he's properly equipped with a pressure suit that's going to keep him from boiling his blood or losing a limb or something like that. That he's going to have the parachutes, the fail safes, the checks, everything. All of that was done by who?
Initially, it was done by the governments. Is that what you're getting at?
No, this time out.
Oh, okay. This
who wrote the check this time?
It was done by Red Bull.
Red Bull, an energy drink maker. Okay, so that's the difference right there. We've gone from, I'm sure Red Bull makes good money. They're obviously a very successful business. But we've gone from something that had to be overseen by the U.S. Air Force to something that can be overseen by somebody who manufactures a very popular consumer good. And they were able to top the prior achievement. Now, a lot of things contributed to that. A lot of technological development has occurred in the meantime that they were able to take advantage of. But still, that's a big, big step down, from the United States Air Force to Red Bull. And it speaks to the capability explosion and the possibility explosion that that we were talking about last week and that we talk about every week, that more of us can do more. And I should say, more of us as individuals, fewer of us can do more than it used to take a lot of us to do. Or individuals can do things that only big organizations at one time could do. And
of course, the thing that we bring up all the time when this subject comes up is the fact that normal people can do a podcast. If you wanted to do a radio show, a radio type show 10 or 15 years ago, you better know somebody with a radio station and all the equipment it took to produce something like that. Now, a couple of guys with laptops and cell phones are able to do it from almost quite literally nothing. I mean, Phil, it doesn't really cost us much of anything to do this show. And it's fun. So we do it. My son Matthew has an interest in doing film, and he's got this high definition camera and everything. But he found something that he's been playing with over the last few weeks, which is a piece of software that allows him to use characters from video games to make his own animation. He can make animation. He can just pull the 3D renderings, you know, right out of a video game and make animation with it. And so he's had a whole lot of fun with that. That's, you know, that kind of capability, you know, garage bands are everywhere now, and you can download their music from, you know, places like podsafe.com, things like that. Because, you know, anybody that has the talent and the desire can do some of these things that formerly was, you know, just an elite few could do.
Well, that's a great example because that speaks to the kind of convergence that also opens up huge possibilities for us. You've got it's not just new technology, because there is a new piece of technology in the mix of what you just described, which is the software that's actually letting him grab those characters. But you've got this existing stuff, right? You say you like to make movies, you know, so there's all that capability already exists, and the video games already exist, and suddenly the ability to combine things or to do new things with existing infrastructure, with existing materials, opens up huge new possibilities. And I wrote about that earlier this week on this story, which doesn't seem related, but honest, these things all tie together in a really interesting way. The story about the cardboard bicycle. This is a great story. This guy, Ijar Gafni, design and mass production authority expert in Israel, has been working for years to figure out how to do this, and he's figured out how to make a bicycle that will sell for about $20 out of cardboard. The two big tricks to making this happen were apparently he had to get the folding just right, folding of the cardboard just right to make the components that he wanted to make. I'm guessing that the sprockets for the chain must have really been the tricky part. And I'm only assuming that the chain is actually a chain, that the chain isn't made of cardboard. And it looks to me like there's some kind of hard rubber or something on the outside of the tires. But other than that, the whole thing is made of the whole thing is made of cardboard. So he had to fold the cardboard, and he had to come up with a new treatment to totally waterproof cardboard. And in the story,
it looks like
I linked,
there might be the cables for the brakes. It looks still like they're still cables. Literally, that it's just those few components like that that are not cardboard. The rest is. And so that's how it could be done so cheaply. Probably most of the expense of the $20 are those few components he couldn't make out of cardboard.
Well, no doubt, because, I mean, cardboard is not expensive. And it shows him holding it with one hand. I wonder how much it actually weighs, because he has folded and compressed that cardboard pretty well if it's going to hold the weight of an adult person on it, it occurs to me. And I'm really intrigued about his waterproofing process, because he talks about he took components of the bikes and just let them soak in water for months and then pulled them out, and no harm, no damage. They were still completely intact. Exactly the opposite of what you would expect from. In fact, when I put this up on Facebook, that's like one of the first comments somebody leaves. Yeah, how's it handle in the rain? Right? I mean, because
you could just see it falling apart on you.
You think cardboard, it would never hold, and then you think, well, what if it rained? Yeah, those are the two problems. And so somehow by folding and compressing cardboard, he made it strong enough. By making it waterproof, he solves that problem. And then he takes, you know, two ideas that have been around forever, cardboard and bicycles, and combines them in a completely new way. It opens up huge possibilities for transportation for people who would really benefit from having a bicycle. We forget that there are people in the world for whom that's not just a toy, that would be something that could actually be a major contributor to their quality of life. Well, when suddenly they can be mass-produced very cheaply, and I'm guessing $20 is the starting price. I have a feeling he might be able to get them out quite a bit cheaper than that. This has a kind of a feel, to the laptop for every child kind of project, right? It's like now suddenly anybody in the world who needs one can have a bicycle, and that's huge. And it makes you wonder when will the cardboard car be arriving? But just the notion that we can work with things that already exist, and we can get to completely new places, that whole new possibilities open up with just a few incremental changes. No big blazing technological breakthroughs. Some improved folding of cardboard and some improved waterproofing of cardboard, and the will to create something new, and suddenly you've got a completely new thing in the world. The other one I wrote about just today, I don't know if you saw this is actually over on Kickstarter. this project called Lowline. These two New York architects have proposed taking this old trolley station over in the Lower East Side. It's under, I think, Delancey Street in Manhattan, for those who are familiar. It's a big space, underground. You know, they don't run trolleys in New York, haven't for quite some time. It's not subway. It's the old trolley car system. It was built in 1903, has not been used since 1948, so there's a huge cavernous underground space that no one is doing anything with, and they're proposing making a park out of it. And you say, well, how do you make a park? In fact, in the video, one of the guys says, I know, that sounds dark and creepy or dark and weird or something like that. And it's like, yeah, it's immediately what you think. You don't want to make a park out of an underground, you know, that's where Beauty and the Beast should be hanging out or something like, you know, Phantom of the Opera or something like that. Well, these guys have improved on technology for concentrating and redistributing solar energy. So this concept already exists, but they think they've got a superior way of doing it, and they've got concept photographs showing what this park will look like, and it will look well lighted, and they say that their technique will actually enable photosynthesis. It will be that what they'll be bringing down into this underground area will be bright enough sunlight that it will enable plants to grow, and you'll have trees, you'll have grass, and you'll have apparent daylight, and you've got these huge vaulted ceilings from this old from this old trolley car station. And so now you've got a park where there was no room to put a park in New York because all the surfaces is already covered over. Once again, using something that already exists, an incremental improvement on an existing technology, or even a new technology in this instance, and huge new possibilities opening up. And as I mentioned in the piece over in Better All the Time, this is really exciting for any number of reasons. I mean, when you can capture and distribute solar technology like that, you've got the possibility of supporting another breakthrough that we've talked about in an urban setting, vertical farms. You think about things like, well, what if you hollowed out an asteroid, right, and you wanted it to have daylight in there, build a little world out in space? Well, you could do that. And actually, it occurred to me, even just lighting homes, lighting offices, lighting businesses, how nice to actually bring the sunlight in if that becomes possible. So it's a very cool technology, and it opens up huge possibilities. So when you look at these factors working together, okay, the handoff of capability from large institutions and rich people to smaller groups and everybody, the ability to apply new ideas to small incremental improvements on existing stuff and get totally new things. I suggested in the write-up to the show that what we're about to enter is an age when everybody gets their, as I called it, Baumgartner moment. And Stephen, as you pointed out, we've had ours, right? We're having ours right now, and it's been our privilege to have our Baumgartner moment for years. I certainly don't mean that everybody is going to become a supersonic skydiver. That's not what I mean by saying that that we'll all have our Baumgartner moment. In fact, a friend of mine took up skydiving recently, and she was telling me how much I would enjoy it, telling me that this is really something I should give a try. And I've been parasailing once, okay, like, 15 years ago. So, you know, I'm an old hand at those kinds of things. My immediate response was, well, actually, what would you say, Stephen, if somebody told you, oh, skydiving, you got to try it? What would your answer be?
I would tell them no. No way.
You know what I felt too? I went to that. Well, I've got young children. I really couldn't take a hobby like that up. It wouldn't be right to take up a dangerous hobby like that. Because yes, actually, my real response is, I'm not jumping out of an airplane. Are you kidding me?
Are you crazy?
I'm not doing that.
I have flown small airplanes. I was a student pilot. I soloed. I was getting enough hours to where I could have gotten my private pilot's license, and it just proved too expensive while I was trying to pay down student debt back in those days. Okay, so I gave that up. But I had a good time flying airplanes. But I can't imagine why I would ever want to leave one in mid-flight. You know, it just doesn't appeal to me at all. I have tried powered parachutes, and that was a good time. you know, that's a real easy sort of flying that if someone's interested in just getting off the ground and what that would be like. And, you know, it doesn't require much training at all. You know, you take off at about 20 miles an hour, you fly at 20 miles an hour, and you land at 20 miles an hour. And it just doesn't require a lot of technical skill. But it's a lot of fun. So
yeah, and I think there are individuals for whom their Baumgartner moment actually will be something like that. You know, flying an ultralight or flying some new variation that's likely to crop up here in the next few years. People are going to be printing out all kinds of interesting aircraft parts in their garages in the years to come. And people are going to be doing all kinds of interesting things with aeronautics, with aviation, but across the board, as is mentioned in the chat room, you know, when you can like publish your own book on Amazon, right? That's very much a Baumgartner moment for the people who otherwise would have had to go to a publisher and go through all these approvals and filters to accomplish what just a few could do at one time. Now, just about everybody can do. I think about
there was a Baumgartner moment during his flight. You might not. I don't think you could guess it. So let me just throw this out.
Okay.
8 million people watched that flight and
wow.
His jump. 8 million people watched it, and it wasn't on any television channel.
Wow.
You know, this was webcast. To me, that's pretty cool.
That's amazing.
You know, that it had numbers like that. I mean, there are cable channels that would kill for that kind of viewership, you know.
That's great ratings, absolutely, yeah.
And so, you know, when just webcast shows, and I guess you could call this a show, this is a reality TV, are drawing those kind of numbers, that's another decentralization. You don't have three stations anymore. You don't even have just the cable stations. Now, anybody that wants to put a video image out there for other people to see, I mean, there's YouTube and there's everything else. So that's another huge avenue.
Absolutely. And it's so much better that we have Baumgartner to stick this label on so that we don't have to refer to it as people's Justin Bieber moment, I suppose, right? But he's
exactly.
Yeah, right. He's another example, right? I built this huge career on YouTube, right?
Exactly.
Channels that might not have otherwise been available, and he might not have. Oh, there's a thought. See, there is a downside, I suppose. He might not otherwise have been a big star. Huh? There you go. So you got to, you got to take all sides of this. I think we see it in a lot of different ways, and it speaks to not only how much more capable people are, it speaks to what they can imagine themselves doing, and I think it speaks to how affluent people have become. That relatively speaking, in terms of just what your economic buying power will get you, when you consider the number of that within living memory, no one had ever climbed to the top of Everest, and now people are doing it all the time, right? People make a hobby out of doing that, right? A lot more just go to base camp, but that's pretty astounding too when you think about it. As just a tourist thing, people go up to Mount Everest base camp. I think about things like in the 60s, there were experiments exploring the Marianas Trench, and now James Cameron, right, a rich guy, is able to do much more sophisticated versions of that kind of exploration than the government was able to do. In fact, timeline-wise, that very much parallels what we're seeing here in this instance with aeronautics. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if in a few years we'll see private individuals ballooning to great heights. I don't know if they'll skydive. I just think people might like to go up and have a look, or diving to great depths, and doing a lot of these kinds of things that are right now only out on the very far edge, but that will become increasingly part of the purview, part of what people expect to have happen. It will be no stranger than when a friend a while back told me she was taking a cruise to the Galapagos, right? Which is like, wow, that's really cool. But you hear that and you don't go, oh, you know, it's not as if she said, I'm flying up to 150,000 feet in a balloon, right? And staying in a hotel in space or near space, if you will, Jeb. And yet, I think that pretty soon we'll hear things like that, and they will sound just about as normal to us as taking a cruise to the Galapagos does now. So everyone, be thinking about what your Baumgartner moment is going to be, and I don't think we have to have just one. I think we've all got a lot of them coming to us. But it's the capability to do something that in the past was not possible because the technology didn't support it, or was possible only for a limited few, and now it's possible for any of us who really want to do it.
Well, you know, one thing that's going to be a huge enabler of this sort of thing is going to be the 3D printers. You know, growing up as a kid, you might have had this idea, somebody ought to invent such and such, you know. Wouldn't it be great if we had, you know, this thing that could do this? And you just had this idea. Well, I mean, if someone has an idea like that now, it doesn't take much to get a prototype of it. And, you know, then you could, I suppose you could shop it around for, see if somebody was interested in manufacturing it. Of course, in a few years, you'll just be selling the 3D plans for it so other people could print out their own.
Right.
But that's just another avenue by which people can be creative that in ways that they couldn't before.
Or channel their creativity in ways that, that weren't available before. Absolutely.
Can I mention something about the jump this weekend? When he exited that capsule, he entered a spin pretty quickly, and it looked kind of that looked hairy, didn't it? I mean, that did not look good. You know, it occurred to me while I was watching, I said, you know, there's no air up there to stop the spin.
Right.
And, you know, what he really needs is maybe some sort of jet stabilization or rocket stabilization, you know, built into the suit or something to, if he starts the spin or something, it can keep that from continuing or whatever. And he was able to get it under control, but I'm sure it had a lot to do with the fact that he's just this incredible skydiver that's got thousands of jumps under his belt.
He understands the physics of that in a more than just theoretical way. I mean, he feels it in his body, right? You know what that spin is and how to deal with it.
I was laughing with my family it was apparent that he was out of danger. I was laughing with him. I said, you know, I would have never been able to straighten that out because I couldn't see through the vomit in my visor. it would have been terrible, but it's you know, I as far as what you know, what good can be done, you know, this is a first step to, you know, knowing what it would be like to bail out from orbit, you know, do the Star Trek thing, you know, where
right.
they bailed out from orbit over the planet Vulcan, and they, you know, they go after that drill thing, you know. I've read this elsewhere that you know, there's really some interest in being able to do that. You know, if there's a problem with the space station or any kind of orbital vehicle, you know, it'd be great if you could just put on your spacesuit and head home. You know, I think this is the first step towards understanding some of what's needed. Maybe if you know, they see, okay, he had the problem with spin. Maybe we built the rockets into the suit that would automatically stop that. Stuff like that. And of course,
yeah,
you know,
for sure,
would be an
for
issue.
Sure. If you were going to do that ultimate skydive from orbit, you'd be talking about a spacesuit that is in many ways a spacecraft, a very small spacecraft, right?
Exactly.
In terms of the heat shielding and the stabilizers and the things that would be on there, but we're that much closer to it now. We understand it more than we did before, for sure.
Absolutely.
Okay, so what other interesting things do we have going on this week? I mentioned in our show notes that there would be other topics of interest. What else we got, Stephen?
This was interesting, I thought. A massive and illegal geoengineering project has been detected off of Canada's west coast. Now, this is according to io9.com. Which
our buddy George Dvorsky, I believe, wrote that.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, this is fascinating to me. This guy by the name of Russ George, in conjunction with the First Nations village on Hadi Gwai, it's an island community, okay? dumped about 100 tons of iron sulfate into the Pacific Ocean in a technique known as ocean fertilization. The experiment, which is in violation of two United Nations moratoria, has outraged environmentalists, attorneys, and civic groups. It's dumped into the Pacific. It was dumped back in July, and now satellite images are confirming that an artificial plankton bloom of massive size, 10,000 square kilometers, is developing. And, you know, and we've heard this before. We've actually mentioned this on the show. If we really were concerned about global warming, this is one way you address it. You would dump iron, particularly in iron poor parts of the ocean, like south of Australia, which is very the ocean is very anemic there, and you dump in iron there and get these kind of plankton blooms. It would sequester carbon dioxide, as it sequesters it by bringing in the carbon dioxide, releasing the oxygen from the plankton blooms, and then the carbon dioxide then goes to the bottom of the ocean. Now, we don't know the secondary effects. So even though I think this guy is completely a nut for having done this just on his own and broke all kinds of laws and national and international laws, no doubt, in doing this, we can learn a lot from what happens now. And, we can use this as a learning experience. And it'll be interesting to watch.
It was a really interesting story to see break, because nobody ever does rogue geoengineering,
That's what this guy did. He's our first rogue geoengineer. I guess he decided, it's getting hot around here. Let's do something about it. Let's on the AC planet-wide. Now, it's interesting how he had hoped that he could make money with this scheme by cashing in on carbon credits. I find that hilarious.
So he wasn't just trying to save the planet. He had ulterior motives.
He had ulterior motives. Iron is cheap. We got this big boat. We fill it up with iron, and let's go out there and see what happens. And now that he's done it, we'll have an opportunity to see if it really does sequester carbon. That was a question. If the carbon dioxide is breathed in by these plants, this plankton, does it just end up back in the atmosphere? Does it end up, bubbling like seltzer out in the ocean right back into the air? Or does it really go to the bottom of the ocean as is thought?
His plan is it gets heavy and then it just sinks and ta-da, you've made the world that much better by taking that much carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. That's the theory.
We'll also get to see what the secondary unintended consequences are, and they're going to be some. What sea critters is this going to hurt? Let's stop this guy. As Ken says in the chat room, get James Bond on this.
There were references over in IO9 to it's got a very Bond villain feel to it, and this is the Eliezer Yudkowsky Moore's Law for Mad Scientists in action here. And this is the flip side of the Baumgartner moment now, isn't it? As greater capability passes into the hands of smaller groups and individuals, suddenly a guy can go create a 10,000 square kilometer plankton field, whatever they called it, patch, right, out in the ocean. I mean, that's not something that one person could have done ever before, right? In fact, I think that probably that's not something the whole government would have figured out how to do at one point not that long ago.
Well, we'll see, we'll see if it really does have the good effects that we like and limited bad effects or It'll be a learning experience. Yes, let's stop the guy now. And since it's already done, it'll be a time for steady, a laboratory for this sort of geoengineering. If we ever need to know how to do it, we might as well study this now and for the future. So,
well, as I pointed out last week, even when people do things for bad motives, if it creates benefits, the benefits will persist. So, you know, even if this guy is a megalomaniac and was trying to make money on top of it, if this works, it works, right? I mean, if this turns out to be a viable approach, which there are a lot of questions about it, then yeah, we might see something like this seriously implemented.
Absolutely. Well, you got anything else, Bill?
Well, I got I got another one. This is just the coolest thing, I think. Earth-sized planet found just next door in the Alpha Centauri system. Anyone who's ever taken high school astronomy knows our nearest stellar neighbor to our star system is the Alpha Centauri system. There's Alpha Proxima and Proxima Centauri. It's a double star system. And if we're ever going to travel to the stars, there's always this, well, wouldn't that be the logical place to start? And in fact, if you remember the TV series Lost in Space, they got lost on their way to Alpha Centauri. Did you know that?
And, you know, apparently they're faster than light drive, dumped them in a random place within the galaxy. And they
somewhere in the middle of the galaxy, yeah. Well, you know,
yeah,
bad luck that. But
but
now we have, not only is it just a mere 4 light years away, a hop, skip, and a jump by galactic standards to Alpha Centauri, but now we got all the more reason to go because there's an Earth-sized planet. It's not likely to be a life-supporting planet. Unfortunately, it's a big rock, big hot rock, because it gets a little too close to Alpha Centauri B. It runs a little too close to one of its suns to be in that Goldilocks zone where we think there could be life. But one of the things that has been observed widely throughout the galaxy as we've learned more and more about planets is that if a star has a planet, it's very likely to have multiple planets. So it's entirely possible that there are other planets, in fact, likely that there are other planets in the Alpha Centauri system, and that just makes that system all the more intriguing. Not only is it the closest one, but turns out the closest one has planets. And doesn't that tell you, if all the other evidence we've gathered up to this point hasn't pretty much established this, but doesn't that tell you that most stars have planets? I mean, I think we're getting to that point, aren't we?
I've actually heard it said, and I wish I had a link for this, Phil, but I've heard it said that all stars are going to have planets because it's just part of the way the star itself forms, is the dust cloud or the gas clouds, you know, coalesces into a star in the middle, and planets develop around it. The planetary system is part of the star system. In the development of the star, the planets are going to form. And so you just can't hardly have a star without planets. So anyway, I guess we'll find out, won't we, as we are able to look closer at our neighbors.
Yeah. Well, it'll be very, very exciting when a system nearby has a planet that's not only Earth-sized but in the right orbit, and when our ability to observe these things becomes more sophisticated, and when we're able to detect things like oxygen, carbon dioxide, or carbon generally, water, vapor potentially, all that kind of stuff is going to make it really exciting. And these are the kinds of discoveries I think that will eventually have us sending probes, if nothing else, out into interstellar space, because we're just going to want to see what's going on out there a little closer than we currently can. Anyway, very exciting news, and the number of exoplanets just continues to grow. It's I don't know where they are with it now. It's in the hundreds. Is it up to 1,000 yet? I'm not sure.
I think it's up there in the neighborhood of about 1,000. It seems to me that that the number of exoplanets that are known is growing exponentially. I may be wrong about that, but I believe that it's growing faster all the time because our ability to look in multiple directions is increasing.
I remember when there weren't any, and now it's like,
quite easily.
There's at least 800. I'm not sure. Maybe 1,000, as you said, but there's a lot of them now. And they're finding more and more all the time. It's amazing.
Absolutely.
All right. What else?
Okay. Okay. We talk all the time about 3D printers, something I don't think that we've ever mentioned before, and it seems so obvious that it's kind of a companion technology with the 3D printer, is the 3D scanner. And I watched a YouTube video earlier today, this particular 3D scanner. Very, very interesting piece of technology.
So a 3D scanner, step me through that. How does that work? Is it, did you have to pass an object under it? Does it, how's it work exactly?
It's handheld. And it shows this guy, he's got a car door or something that looks like a car door to me. And he's just passing this thing over it, and he's not having to keep it like at a uniform distance, you know, from the thing he's scanning. You know, it doesn't have to be scanned robotically or anything. He's just waving this thing over the car door, and as he does so, the software is able to stitch a 3D image of this car door, and then it's just printing out like a model. It's like, you know, one tenth the size or something. I suppose you could do it the opposite way too. You could scan something that's small and make it big, but, I thought that was very interesting. And one thing I thought was, lacking though, you know, you got the scanner in your hand and you're just waving the scanner over it. And, you know, sometimes it picks up enough detail when you pass it by and sometimes it doesn't. And the guy is just kind of having to guess at it because he doesn't see what the scanner sees. You know, this thing needs to be integrated with something like Google Glasses, you know, so that you're seeing the thing that's being scanned and see how good the detail is. Oh, we missed a spot over here, and I'll come over here and scan this little cranny here in this thing I'm trying to get. And I think that'd be great. Of course, I suppose you could do the same thing with a small screen on the device, but have it integrated into our glasses that we're all going to be wearing in a few years. That's the way to go with this. So, in the chat,
Sally says, I saw a video of a 3D printer that also served as a scanner. The reporter brought a wrench, and the printer scanned and replicated it. This is how true replicators will begin. That is the missing piece from the replicator on Star Trek, right? They can that you can upload an object, right? You scan it in, and then you have it, and you're able to make as many copies of it as you need. What a world we live in, Stephen. 3D scanners and 3D printers, huh? It's an astounding thought.
Very cool, very cool. I'll just put the YouTube link in the chat room just now.
Well,
so
we predicted last week that within 5 years, 3D printers will be a common household object, common household item. Do you think that it's fair to say that 3D scanners will as well?
Yeah, and I think it'll be one of these deals where, well, you have a 3D printer, you need a scanner. You know, I guess there's some people that might just need the printer for some reason. You know, if all you're going to do is download designs by other people, but you know, the scanner is not, I don't think it's going to be terribly expensive. You know, it might start kind of expensive, but I think it'll get cheap quick. You know, and so once it does, I mean, it won't be any big deal to get a scanner. You know, I imagine the paper scanners. You know how expensive they were at one time, and now
they're built into printers, which, as we demonstrated on a show about post scarcity a while back, those are practically free anymore.
Practically,
right?
Yeah.
The ink that goes in them is usually more expensive than the printers themselves. I wouldn't be at all surprised if we saw something similar happen with 3D printers and 3D scanners. Whether they'll be built in or they'll be separate components, that we'll find out. I imagine actually your iPhone or whatever your item you'll be carrying around 5 years from now will be your 3D scanner. It wouldn't even occur to you that you'd have a separate item. It'll be that, you know. It'll take a nice 3D picture and, you know, send it straight over your 3D printer, and boom, you're in business. Well, my other big topic for tonight was this. We've seen headlines all over the place about scientific evidence that we are living in a computer simulation. I'll tell you what I'm going to do is I'm going to shelf that one until last week. We'll make that the headline for next week. And with about a minute left before we need to cut over to music, Stephen, did you have one other nugget you want to share with us this evening?
Well, one piece of bad news about the SpaceX. You know, we so admired having the first successful private cargo mission. As you know, they lost an engine, Phil, on blastoff.
Yep. And they made it to orbit anyway, which was cool.
Yeah, made it to orbit anyway by just adding more power to the remaining engines. And it was not a big deal, really, right? Well, it kind of was a deal because for whatever reason, the loss of that engine meant that a satellite that was being carried on that launch was lost. And it's a communication satellite. And so, you know,
it was lost in what sense? It was damaged? They had to jettison it? What happened?
No, it couldn't. They could not, for whatever reason, get it to the altitude it needed to be.
Oh, I see.
To be in a proper orbit. And it ended up, the satellite re-entered and burned up. And so it's a total loss. But, you know, space is a tricky thing. You know, glad that they were able to make their delivery to the space station successfully. But I'm sure they're going to spend a lot of time figuring out what do we do to create to increase the reliability of these engines. And so,
yeah,
you know, good luck to those guys.
Yeah, it was very impressive that that it recovered from that engine failure. Indeed, sad to learn that it wasn't a complete recovery, that the whole mission wasn't accomplished. But watch how quickly they recover from that, and watch what extraordinary things SpaceX will be doing in its next few missions. I have a lot of confidence that we're going to see really extraordinary things from them.
Excellent. Yeah, I agree.
All right. Well, I can tell you that next week we're going to start out talking about whether we're living in a computer simulation. I don't know. Is it too soon to do another whole show on that? It seems like that's one we can just, you know, we can always talk about consciousness, too, if we want to, right?
It seems like those subjects seem to come around a lot. But
Didn't we tell Jim Elvich he had to come back? I think we should have him come and talk about this, because I have a strong suspicion that this scientific evidence thing is way overblown, and I'd like to try that. Test that with Jim, but we'll wait and see if he's available. If not, I'll get an email from him, and we'll discuss it next week. But meanwhile, what's our music?
Our music tonight is Long Island Sound by Brian Sharp.
Brian Sharp with Long Island Sound. Well, thanks for putting that together, Stephen, and thank you all for being with us this evening. Those listening live, those listening via MP3, and especially our friends in the chat room, thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We'll be back again next week to talk about whether we're living in a computer simulation. And don't forget, 3 weeks from tonight, the 250th Blog Talk Radio episode of Fast Forward Radio. Don't want to miss that one. Hope to be with you all then. And until then, live to see it.
Flying over a dreary Monday rain, dripping droplets washing into the sea. I get out of the cab at 45th and 9th, asking how I could be getting here on time. Then I see you in the high rise, then I'm near you underneath these New York skies. Waiting hours to see you move your legs, begging someone that look, a movement, a little dancing star, hiding from your eyes cause you don't wanna go that far. When I see you in the high rise, when I'm near you underneath these New York skies. And someday in these days I just met, listening to Manhattan radio, losing my last chance, cause I wonder if you know that when I see you, something in me cries to be near you, underneath these New York skies.